KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
I'm worried.
Tens of thousands of Palestinians have been displaced in the Israeli military's latest operation in the occupied West Bank. It's the largest displacement to happen there in years.
It's Tuesday, February 25th, and this is All Things Considered.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. The city of Huntsville, Alabama could benefit from the Trump administration.
Some local officials expect him to move Space Command to their city.
We're going to grow, and we're going to continue to grow with or without Space Command, but obviously we have an interest in it.
And an excursion with a local tour guide in Greenland.
He takes me on a boat ride to view the massive icebergs that draw tourists to the remote island.
Oh my God, I choose this lifestyle instead of being inside an office. I'm enjoying life in the water.
First, these headlines.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. A roller coaster for House Speaker Mike Johnson tonight, who's been working to bring a sweeping budget bill to the House floor for a vote. The Speaker nearly forced to pull the measure at the last minute when it became clear a handful of conservative fiscal hawks who wanted deeper spending cuts were unwilling to support it. However, voting is underway at this hour. The sweeping measure includes $4.5 trillion in tax cuts and new spending. It also includes spending cuts, but it would increase the deficit by more than $2 trillion. It would boost spending for defense and immigration enforcement. President Trump is creating a new visa program to court wealthy foreigners. He's describing his plan as a gold card that would cost $5 million. Bureau's Asma Khalid has more.
The president intends to roll out a new immigration program in about 2 weeks. He calls it a gold card that is akin to a green card for people with a lot of money.
It's going to be a route to citizenship, and wealthy people will be coming into our country by buying this card. They'll be wealthy. And they'll be successful, and they'll be spending a lot of money and paying a lot of taxes and employing a lot of people.
The president said he could envision selling a million or more of these cards to raise revenue. This new measure would effectively replace the EB-5 immigrant investor visa, which allows foreigners to gain residency in the United States if they create American jobs and businesses. Asma Khalid, NPR News, The White House.
The White House appears to be sending a clear signal to the press corps amid an ongoing controversy with the Associated Press over its refusal to officially recognize the administration's renaming the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of America. The White House now says it will decide which news outlets can cover President Trump. That departs from a century-long tradition of independence, where the White House Correspondents Association ran the pool through a rotation of members. Eugene Daniels covers the White House for Politico and is the current president of the WHCA.
This is bigger than the WHCA. This is about the White House press corps and having the right people covering the president of the United States, and that's independent news organizations that aren't chosen by the president of the United States.
White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt says legacy outlets may still be in the pool, but new voices will be added, including streaming services and local radio hosts. On Wall Street, the broad market fell further from recent record run-ups. That was amid heightened concerns about the confidence of U.S. consumers and the possible inflationary effects of proposed Trump administration tariffs against major U.S. trading partners. The tech sector and cryptocurrencies also took a hit in some cases today. Blue chips did close higher, though, up 159 points to 43,621. The Nasdaq dropped 260 points to 19,026 today. The Standard & Poor's 500 was up 28 points to end the session at 5,955. You're listening to NPR News in Washington. The Trump administration is launching an investigation into whether to impose tariffs on copper imports for national security reasons. That's according to a White House official speaking to reporters on condition of anonymity. President Trump signed an executive action today mandating the probe. The official said China's been flooding world markets with subsidized copper, and the U.S. has boosted imports and fallen behind in smelting and refining capacity despite having considerable reserves in Alaska and Arizona. China is not among the world's top copper exporters. It's not clear how quickly the investigation might happen. Rhiannon is the latest artist to cancel a performance at the Kennedy Center. As NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports, the Grammy and Pulitzer Prize-winning musician announced she's moving her show to another venue in Washington.
Rhiannon Giddens writes on social media that her May 11th concert at the Kennedy Center was scheduled, quote, long before the current administration decided to take over this previously non-political institution. Earlier this month, President Trump terminated and replaced Kennedy Center leadership, making himself chairman of the board. Giddens says Kennedy Center tickets will be refunded and that her show will move to the D.C. venue, The Anthem. Other artists who've canceled appearances include mystery writer Louise Penny, citing Trump's takeover as the reason, and the Brooklyn-based Puerto Rican band Balloon. The Kennedy Center says its new leadership has not made any programming changes. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News, Washington.
Concerns about the effects of proposed Trump administration tariffs, given the global nature of oil prices, further roiled commodities today. Oil fell by 2.5%. You're listening to NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Jane Gross, whose bequest supports NPR's commitment to creating a more informed public by distributing programming that meets the highest standards of public service and journalism. This is NPR.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Tens of thousands of Palestinians have been displaced in the past month by the Israeli military's current operation in the occupied West Bank. It's the largest displacement there in many decades. Israel now says it's intensifying what it calls counterterrorism efforts, and that people who have fled will not be allowed to return home. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reports.
At a small school in a village outside of Jenin in the northern area of the West Bank, children run around on a playground. It's a relatively normal scene, except that these aren't the school's students.
We have about 25 families.
Taysir Ode is the head of this school, usually a boarding school for the blind, but operations were suspended as Israeli military activity intensified in the area. Now they're housing nearly 100 people who fled the violence.
This is a huge number of families.
Ode says they're full, but people still come every day to ask if they have room. For now, the families are mainly from one neighborhood, the Jenin refugee camp, which is where Israel's current military operation started more than a month ago and has been a focus since. But Ode thinks it could just be a matter of time until the violence spreads further, maybe even to his village nearby.
I am worried.
Down the hall, the school's kitchen is bustling. Women from the displaced families are gathered cooking. One group sits at a table in the middle of the kitchen drinking tea and talking, including Sana'a Ashrim, looking a little dejected, chin resting on her hand. She says she and her family, including her one-month-old granddaughter, fled their home as the Israeli military came in. They had to leave suddenly, she says, taking very little with them. She says she's thankful they have somewhere to stay that's free and safe, but she's never been displaced before, and it's hard. I'm so stressed, she says. I miss my house, I miss my neighborhood. I keep asking, when can we go home? Saida and Amid, who's been sitting at the table, jumps in. She doesn't think anyone will be going home anytime soon. The Israelis want to displace people now. That's their objective, she says. They're emptying the land. Last week, Israel's defense minister, Israel Katz, visited troops in the West Bank. In a video statement from there, he said Israel will be, quote, intensifying its operation, which Israel says is for counterterrorism, and has spread to several refugee camps. According to both the UN and the Israeli government, more than 40,000 Palestinians have been displaced from those camps, which have long been militant strongholds, but are also built-up urban areas with apartment buildings, family housing, schools, and hospitals. But now, few residents are left. Over the weekend, Katz put out a statement saying that the Israeli military will remain in the camps for the coming year, a significant change in policy, and that Israel will, quote, prevent the return of residents. Palestinian leaders reject this and fear it will lead to Israel annexing these parts of the West Bank, land that is internationally recognized as Palestinian but has been under Israeli military occupation for decades. We drive into the eastern part of Jenin City. Even here, streets have been ripped up and buildings damaged in a recent Israeli military raid.
Assalamu alaikum.
44-year-old Rana Abu Khattab is living in a small borrowed basement apartment with her husband and five children after fleeing the violence. There are cots and blankets on the floor, along with two small couches. She says they went back to their home in the camp a few weeks ago, a risky move, to try to get some belongings. They were shocked by what they found. Her 21-year-old daughter, Malik, takes out her phone and pulls up a video. In it, the family walks through their three-story home. The structure is still standing, but barely. Walls and windows have been blasted. The inside is full of rubble. Furniture is broken. The camera pans outside to show many of the surrounding buildings have been destroyed as well. The Israeli military says it's been dismantling buildings that it says are terrorist infrastructure. Rana tears up watching the video. You work so hard in your life to build something, she says, and all of it goes in 1 second. She says they don't have money to rent or buy, and they can't stay here long term. She doesn't know what they'll do. But for now, her main concern is finding more blankets for her kids. It's cold in the basement. And then, she says, they'll just take it one day at a time. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Jenin in the occupied West Bank.
One of the first things tour operator Jan Kortzen tells me when we meet is that I'm not wearing enough layers. We are in a working boatyard in Ilulissat, a small town north of the Arctic Circle. Kortzen's going to take us out on his boat to explore the icebergs that lure many tourists to Greenland. And even though it has been unseasonably warm during our 12-day trip here, he warns that the wind will be biting. He shows off a plastic bag with two freshly caught cod. He'd been out guiding a fishing trip earlier in the day.
Fresh cod. Caught it this morning?
Yeah.
Nice. Two whole cod in a bag. A little bit.
I will eat the liver and the stomach with the fish.
To reach the boat, I take cautious steps across the frozen blue sea ice.
It's incredible. We're walking past all of these boats that are literally sitting on top of the ice, which is feels pretty firm under my feet, fingers crossed.
I notice that some of the ice is splattered with fish blood and seal parts. Someone has left a frozen shark carcass on top of the ice.
The terrain is not level. There are little jagged pieces of ice that pop up and down.
Kortzen's boat is tied up at the edge of the ice. He chips off the thin edge he says is too dangerous to stand on. Kortzen kicks on the engine, and we set off.
We will sail by close to the icebergs. The mountains, like, in the water, that we only can see the top of the icebergs, then the rest, 70 to 90% is down under. Some of these can be up to 100 meter high and be very, very dangerous. Probably these can break off without warning. These big ones, yeah.
At one point, Kortzen pulls the boat close to this massive outcropping of ice and uses a hook to pull the boat closer. I reach my hand out.
So we just pulled a chunk off. This is from the very beginning of the ice fjord. Holding in my hand, it's a little bit bigger than a softball.
Just remember, these are 60,000-year-old ice.
60,000-year-old ice in my hand.
Yeah.
It's pretty incredible.
As we speed toward the glinting white and sapphire blue icebergs, Kortzen tells us his story. He was born in this small city of fewer than 5,000 people. He tried other careers, but says his love of the outdoors and of traditional Inuit culture led him to start working as a tour guide.
Yeah, I was working with big machines, and every time I stopped in a good view, then I look and relax and say to myself, in the future, I want to be in the water and working with my guests in my own company.
The water's a little choppy, and I hold on to one of the guardrails with a gloved hand.
Just remember, you are extreme. You are sailing in wintertime in Greenland.
We are extreme. We are sailing in wintertime in Greenland.
So now you can call yourself extreme tourists.
Do you get many tourists during the winter? Do you get many extreme tourists?
I want many extreme tourists in the future.
Soon, Greenland will be more accessible to tourists than ever before. Greenland has invested hundreds of millions of dollars in the industry in recent years. There's a new airport in Nuuk opened a few months ago that will bring international visitors directly to Greenland's capital. When those flights start this summer, American tourists will be able to fly from the East Coast to Greenland in about 4 hours. I asked Kortson whether he worries about the risks of over-tourism. An influx of tourists could put strain on the island's limited infrastructure, and the remote nature of Greenland is part of its draw. Kortson says he's not concerned.
I'm welcoming people because I want to show my beautiful country to other people. We have only one life, and we have a big country, and we are only 56,000 people. So I'm not worried.
In 2023, foreign tourism added nearly $270 million to Greenland's economy. That's according to Visit Greenland, the National Tourism Authority. Kortson is a part of a collective of Inuit tour operators. The group wants to make sure those tourism dollars go back into the local economy.
We want to be together because we want to be stronger, because we want to show what we local can do in our own country. Because we know where we can catch fish or seals or something like that. We know what we are doing. And it's about to show the real Greenland with other cultures.
At one point, Kortson kills the engine. We're floating, surrounded by ice. He looks at us and tells us,
just enjoy the moment.
The only things I hear are the water lapping at the side of the boat, the breeze, and the sound of my own breath. On reporting trips like these, with so much to explore, there often aren't many moments of stillness. I want to memorize the way this moment feels.
I mean, we're essentially standing in one of your offices. This must be so fun for you to take people out to see these icebergs. Do you enjoy it?
Oh my God. I choose this lifestyle instead of being inside an office. I'm enjoying life in the water. It's my second home.
On tomorrow's show, we meet a Greenlandic chef who teaches us about traditional cuisine.
This is the whale blubber from the narwhal.
From the narwhal.
Or you have from a young, a teenage narwhal.
From a teenage narwhal, wow.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you. Support for NPR comes from this station and from Hiscox, committed to helping small businesses protect their dreams. Quotes and information on customized insurance for specific risks are available at Hiscox.com. Hiscox, business insurance experts. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at LodestarFoundation.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at MacFound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. MSNBC's main stars lined up last night to pay tribute to their colleague, Joy Reid. She thanked her fans for support over the life of her show.
Thank you, thank you, thank you for holding us down. Almost 5 years, we are a toddler, and we out in these streets in this world, and we are not going to stop.
Reid's 7 p.m. Daily Show is now over, and the network has made a flurry of other programming changes in recent days. Some fans are concerned that the network is backing away from its liberal identity. NPR's David Folkenflik joins us now with the latest. Hi there.
Hey, Juana.
So, David, just start by telling us, what is driving all of this change?
Well, let's say from the start, it's pretty common for network news or cable news channels, to redefine or refine at the start of any presidential administration how they approach things. They often take it as a reset. This is a pretty big one, and there's a big corporate reason driving it. MSNBC is part of a new corporation involving some of its sister cable channels that have been spun off from NBC and its corporate parent at Comcast because there's concern over the future of cable and cable news in an era of slashing of the cord, right? And so what they're trying to do is figure out a fresh strategy to figure out what their new budget looks like when they are cut apart from the mothership over at NBC and its newsroom there.
Okay, a fresh strategy, a new budget. How is all that playing out so far?
Well, you saw the questioner Joy Reid. They looked at her ratings. They decided it was wanting, declined sharply, at least at the end of last year, beginning of this, after the presidential election. They want to do better in that 7 p.m. slot. You similarly saw some other shows shaken up. You saw Alex Wagner. Her show four times a week in primetime is gone. She'll be a correspondent for the network. She's being replaced. So, you know, they've also are going to retool a bunch of the weekends. These are things that have gotten a lot of people very agitated who care a lot about MSNBC. And you're seeing a bit of a victory dance from pro-MAGA types.
All right, I just want to tick through a couple of the names of other anchors who have lost shows. They include Jonathan Capehart, Joy Reid, Katie Fang. These are all people of color. Reid, I will just note, has also been an outspoken critic of President Trump. Is there some concern here about a purge of anti-Trump liberals and people of color on the MSNBC staff?
Well, you're certainly seeing that concern online. Let's start, though, with people of color. Most people on the weekends, aside from Katie Fang, who will remain with the network as a correspondent on legal matters, they're sticking around. In fact, they're expanding to weekend shows for people who are people of color. And they're taking one of the week of shows that works and bringing them in to replace Joy Reid's show. Why does that matter? Why, you know, is that a question of anti-Trump liberals being purged? No, these folks are all vehemently anti-Trump. You have among them a former spokeswoman for Kamala Harris and Bernie Sanders and a very anti-Trump former head of the RNC. These are figures that do that as well. When you think about other questions of liberals being purged, you know, you have Jen Psaki, Joe Biden's former White House press secretary. She's being the replacement for Alex Wagner over there at the 9 p.m. hour, right, during the weekdays.
David, last thing quickly, what other changes might we expect there?
So MSNBC may still have those last initials of NBC, but it has to chart the separate court. It's having to staff up for reporters. It's having to create its own Washington bureau. You're seeing them say, we have to be able to stand on our own feet when we leave the NBC fold formally at the end of this year.
NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, thank you.
You bet.
There are now two drugs on the market that can sometimes slow down Alzheimer's disease. NPR's John Hamilton has been talking to people who've taken these drugs, and today he has the story of one of the first patients to receive the drug now marketed as Leqembi.
Sue Bell started taking Leqembi in 2020 as part of a clinical trial. In 2023, when Sue was 71, she described her memory this way.
Oh, it's waning. It's some days I'm better than others. I don't know. Ken could probably tell you as much as that.
Ken is Sue's husband. We were chatting in their kitchen in St. Charles, Missouri. They were telling me how Sue's memory problems had begun about 4 years earlier.
Did you know you were having memory problems? Could you tell?
No.
Well, now wait a
minute. Well, all right. Well, he might.
You're the one who brought it up.
Did I?
Because you were doing.
Well, I didn't remember that.
You were doing some part-time substitute teaching.
Sue would come home from work and tell Ken she was having trouble spelling words.
And that's why we went to see our primary care physician.
I didn't remember all that.
Okay.
That's part of the problem.
Yeah, that's part of the problem. I didn't remember all that.
That's how it really all started.
Next came cognitive tests, brain scans, and a diagnosis, early-stage Alzheimer's. So in 2020, Sue volunteered for a study in St. Louis. Researchers there were studying an experimental drug. Sue knew it was unlikely to help her.
I'm the kind of person that I would like to help somebody else, too. And that's what I was in this for.
The drug was Leqembi, then known by its generic name, lecanemab. It's designed to clear the brain of beta amyloid, which forms the sticky plaques that are a hallmark of Alzheimer's. Leqembi is one of two drugs on the market that can modify the disease process rather than just treat its symptoms. Sue and Ken began making twice-monthly trips to St. Louis, where she got Leqembi by intravenous infusion.
Needles don't bother me anyway, so that was a good plus.
Ken and Sue knew the drug had risks and was, at best, a stopgap measure.
The hope was anything we could do to keep pushing things out and so forth, that at some point, maybe it would come up something that would either reverse the symptoms or cure it even.
At first, the drug seemed to help. Sue was able to take a trip to New York.
It was a great trip. We had five girls.
It was really six girls because it
was it?
Daughter. Two daughter-in-laws.
Oh, I forgot that.
And two teenage grandkids.
Okay, I forgot grandgirls. That.
Yes. There were six of them.
It was very fun. We just walked all over the place.
Even when Sue's memory got worse, the couple kept making the half-hour drive from St. Charles to St. Louis for treatment. In late 2024, I got an update from Ken, but not Sue.
I didn't think it would help to have her participate today, honestly.
Sue's Alzheimer's had reached the point where the drug was unlikely to help.
We decided that we were kind of wasting our time coming down there all the time, so we suspended taking the drugs probably back in February.
Sue's experience with Leqembi is pretty typical, says Dr. Joy Snyder, a neurologist at the Knight Alzheimer's Disease Research Center at Washington University.
Some people do progress, and like Sue, she stopped taking the drug through the study. Other people are still doing pretty well. We have a few people still left from that study who are on the medication.
Snyder says that for all its limitations, Leqembi represents a meaningful change in Alzheimer's treatment.
People like Sue and Ken are the reason this drug was approved and the reason we can give hope to a lot of people with this disease.
Ken says that for Sue, though, hope is fading.
She still knows me. She still knows our kids. She still knows some of our better friends and so forth.
Some days, though, she has trouble finding her way around her own house. On one of those days, she began asking Ken to move her to a care home. So Ken found one she liked.
After she was there a few days, every time I would come, she would say, "Take me home. I don't want to be here anymore." And after a month, I brought her back home.
Sue is still at home, but Ken says at some point she'll need more care than he can provide. John Hamilton, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Avian flu has infected dozens of Americans. Experts say the tools to contain previous bird flu outbreaks just aren't working, and farmers are begging for a new approach.
We are in a battle and losing at the moment.
Battling bird flu on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Thank you.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. This week marks 3 years since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Retired Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Venman says he worries the war is far from over.
The question is going to be, do we want Russia to be the winner or do we want the U.S. to be the winner? Does Trump want Putin to be the winner or does he want to be the winner himself?
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. President Trump has appointed a pardon czar who will recommend people who should receive presidential clemency. NPR's Shondalise Duster has more on the woman who will fill that role.
Alice Marie Johnson was given a life sentence with no parole for a first-time nonviolent drug offense. She spent more than 20 years in prison before her sentence was commuted and then fully pardoned by Trump. Now she is being tasked with helping others like her. Johnson has been advocating for criminal justice reform since leaving prison. She told Fox News that she intends to fulfill the trust that Trump has placed in her.
From the time I've been working on this nonstop since my release, this is really a continuation of the work that I've already been doing. I've brought many pardon cases before the president in the past.
Johnson also said she will work with Pastor Paula White Cain, leader of the White House Faith Office, and Attorney General Pam Bondi on recommendations. Shondalise Duster, NPR News.
The Vatican says Pope Francis remains in critical but stable condition. As NPR's Jason DeRose tells us, that's been the case since a respiratory emergency last weekend.
The Pope continues to get CT scans to monitor the pneumonia he has in both lungs. The Vatican press office says the prognosis remains cautious due to the complexity of the situation. It says Francis continues to do some work and received the Eucharist this morning. The 88-year-old Pope has also been showing signs of kidney problems, but doctors say that condition is under control. Around the world, Catholics and others have been praying for Francis's health since he was admitted to the hospital with bronchitis on February 14th. This is his longest hospitalization since being elected Pope in 2013. Jason DeRose, NPR News.
Well, stocks finished mixed on Wall Street as worries over inflation and White House tariffs on foreign goods continues to impact the markets. This is NPR. Here in Los Angeles, Luka Doncic of the L.A. Lakers is set to play tonight against his former team, the Dallas Mavericks, for the first time since his shocking trade earlier this month. Steve Futterman reports.
It is a trade that is still reverberating across the NBA. Luka Doncic, one of the league's best players and considered virtually untradeable, was dealt by the Dallas Mavericks to the L.A. Lakers. The game tonight is sure to be full of emotion. Doncic is coming off his best game since the trade. While the Lakers are playing probably their best basketball of the entire season right now, the same cannot be said of the Mavericks, and the trade may have a lot to do with that. The player Dallas received in exchange for Doncic, Anthony Davis, has been sidelined with an adductor strain, and Davis will not play tonight. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman in Los Angeles.
The Trump administration is moving ahead with tariffs on products from Canada and Mexico following a month-long suspension. Economists say the planned import taxes on America's two largest trading partners could potentially hurt U.S. economic growth and worsen inflation. The news comes as consumer confidence has fallen to its lowest level in nearly 4 years, a sign that American consumers are concerned about the impact a trade war will have on the economy as well as jobs. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments, Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from ECMC Foundation at ECMCFoundation.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. One city that could see big benefits from the Trump administration is Huntsville, Alabama. The state has long supported President Trump, and Alabama politicians expect him to move U.S. Space Command to Huntsville, which is known as Rocket City. But as Stephen Bisaha of the Gulf States Newsroom reports, those gains could be outweighed by Trump's budget cuts in a city built by federal workers.
Redstone Arsenal is not like your typical Army post.
This is the place where America launched its space program.
Mike Ward is with the Huntsville and Madison County Chamber of Commerce. And the driving tour he's leading through the Arsenal's 38,000 acres is pretty much a who's who of federal space and defense agencies, from the big names like NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center.
The place where the Redstone rockets that first put satellites in space and man in space were manufactured over here.
To the less well-known, like the Army Materiel Command Headquarters.
So everything the Army buys, bullets, blankets, helicopters, that command is responsible for managing all of those activities.
Now, North Alabama hopes Trump will add a new tenant to the arsenal.
And this is it.
So this whole stretch here, this empty stretch here?
This whole, all of this area here.
That would be Space Command.
Space Command's job is to coordinate across military branches for their space operations. At the end of his first term, Trump tried to move it from its temporary location in Colorado to Huntsville. But there was a backlash in Colorado. An inspector general's report later found that the decision to move Space Command to Huntsville was sound and not influenced by politics. That didn't stop then-President Joe Biden from canceling the move in 2023, saying that would jeopardize Space Command's readiness.
So I think President Trump has every right to review that process now and determine where that command should be located.
Alabama politicians have been predicting since Election Day that Trump would restart Space Command's move to Alabama.
This is the best place for long-term for Space Command.
That's Huntsville Mayor Tommy Battle. He says Space Command needs Huntsville's talent and infrastructure more than Huntsville needs Space Command's 1,600 jobs.
Many days I have two ribbon cuttings on a day, or two, a ribbon cutting and a groundbreaking. You know, we're going to grow, and we're going to continue to grow with or without Space Command, but obviously we have an interest in it.
I spoke with the mayor the week of Trump's inauguration, and he had this whiteboard that listed challenges for his city. And in that challenge column, changes in federal spending. Trump still hasn't delivered Space Command to Huntsville. Instead, he's spent the last month slashing away at agency budgets and jobs. So I called Battle back up.
Hello, this is Stephen.
Hey, Stephen. Tommy Battle. How are you?
Hey, Tommy. I'm doing
because Redstone Arsenal already has about 45,000 federal workers, and there's a ton of anxiety right now about which jobs will be cut.
I'd say there. You know, you've got to say there's concern. It's just not knowing right now, and it's going to take time to know the full effect of what the DOGE is going to do and how it affects us specifically.
This week, the Department of Defense plans to cut thousands of probationary civilian workers. It's still unclear what this would mean for Huntsville. For now, Battle's talking less about Space Command as a boost to the region than as a way of making up for those potential losses.
Space Command could be, you know, could also be part of a plan B if there are cuts somewhere else.
Battle says the city's weathered federal cuts before, but the speed of these cuts makes them unique. For NPR News, I'm Stephen Bisaha in Huntsville, Alabama.
Today, the U.S. Supreme Court threw out the conviction and death penalty for Richard Glossop. He's an Oklahoma man who's maintained his innocence for more than 25 years, often coming so close to execution that he ate what was supposed to be his last meal three times. NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg reports.
Richard Glossop has been tried and convicted twice and lost multiple appeals, including one at the Supreme Court, where one justice dismissed his claim as nothing but a, quote, stalling tactic. But today, three of the court's conservatives joined the court's three liberals in concluding that prosecutors had denied Glossop a fair trial not once, but twice. The six-justice majority said that prosecutors had violated Glossop's constitutional rights by concealing exculpatory evidence from the defense, including information about the drug use and mental status of the prosecution's star witness, and by persuading that witness to change his testimony when it conflicted with his prior testimony. Glossop's lawyer, Don Knight, said that his client is beyond thrilled.
He actually has a future that's not going to be on death row.
Prosecutors never contended that Glossop himself bludgeoned motel owner Barry Van Treese to death with a baseball bat. Rather, they ultimately settled on the theory that Glossop, who managed the motel, commissioned handyman Justin Sneed to murder Van Treese, the alleged motive being alternately to steal a wad of cash from the owner or to conceal embezzlement of funds. There was no physical evidence to tie Glossop to the crime, and so prosecutors initially offered to take the death penalty off the table if he testified against handyman Sneed. But when Glossop continued to maintain his innocence, the prosecution offered the deal instead to Sneed, who was sentenced to life in prison while Glossop was convicted and sentenced to die. The case, in many ways, is as remarkable as a true crime miniseries. Most extraordinary is that Glossop's Supreme Court appeal was supported by Oklahoma's Attorney General, Gentner Drummond, a conservative Republican and supporter of the death penalty. After two separate independent investigations found that both Glossop trials had been tainted by prosecutorial misconduct, Drummond took the very rare step of formally asking for a new trial. The Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals, however, refused to accept the Attorney General's so-called confession of error, and the state court maintained that its decision was not reviewable in federal court. Today, the Supreme Court vociferously disagreed. Writing for the court majority, Justice Sonia Sotomayor said that the prosecutors had violated their constitutional obligation to correct false testimony elicited from Sneed, the only witness who tied Glossop directly to the crime. The obligation to correct such false testimony, the court observed, is a clear violation of the court's precedents dating back more than 65 years. Joining Sotomayor and the majority were Chief Justice Roberts and Justices Kagan, Kavanaugh, Jackson, and for the most part, Barrett. Justices Thomas and Alito dissented. Justice Gorsuch was recused. Glossop's lawyer, Don Knight, gives much of the credit for today's win to Attorney General Gentner.
Only he had the courage to say, we're not going to continue to try to kill this man. That's a tremendous amount of political courage for a man who is now running for governor as well. He saw something that was wrong, and he tried to make it right, and he did.
Making the case against Glossop, of course, in the future may be difficult in light of the Supreme Court's decision, especially since he's already served 27 years on death row. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Archbishop Svia Toslav Shevchuk is the head of the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church, the third largest religion in Ukraine. As the Trump administration begins talks with Russia about its war in Ukraine, Shevchuk has been traveling in the United States. Buffy Gorilla has more from Philadelphia, where Shevchuk recently celebrated a mass with members of the Ukrainian diaspora.
On a cold Sunday morning, the pews of Philadelphia's Ukrainian Catholic Cathedral of the Immaculate Conception are packed. Over 1,000 people have come to hear Major Archbishop Sviatoslav Shevchuk, the head of the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church, speak.
To good people of the USA, who in this very dramatic circumstances of my country, stay with us.
especially in this moment when the Ukrainian people receive some mixed signals from the international society. Thank you for being faithful.
Now Ukraine needs a lot of encouragement, and the most that we could get, I'm really thankful for that.
Melania Schnitzer is an undergraduate at Temple University who came with her family to see the Archbishop.
I've never actually seen him before, but I'm glad that he's here because a lot of people will come to these kinds of events from all kinds of states, and it really just brings us closer as a community.
The Ukrainian Greek Catholic community is made up of about 5 million people, and what began as a spiritual mission became a geopolitical one. The Archbishop's pleas come as President Trump has been spreading misinformation about how the war started. According to Professor Kathy Warner from Penn State University, Shevchuk is an important figure at home and abroad.
One of the reasons why he's come to the United States is to make a case for the moral responsibility for helping to achieve peace, certainly in Ukraine, but even elsewhere in the world. I think he has a certain moral authority, and he makes that case quite effectively. He also is trying to renew a sense of hope.
During his visit to the United States, Shevchuk had meetings with representatives of the newly formed White House Faith Office and the U.S. Institute for Peace.
I think when he pushes back against claims that Ukraine started the war or that Zelensky is a dictator, I think we have to take his words quite seriously. He is from Ukraine. He's living throughout this war. He knows that, of course, this is a bald-faced lie. Ukraine did not start the war. It was invaded.
Shevchuk says that some people expect the war to de-escalate in the coming months, but the Archbishop said questions remain about how exactly that would happen.
Will it be a simple ceasefire? Will Ukraine have some guarantees of the protection from those who are talking about peace in Ukraine? But we as a Christians, we do understand that there is no peace without justice. Peace without protecting the human rights. Peace without respect of human dignity. It is simple mockery.
While he is not a politician, Shevchuk has a message for the politicians working to end the war.
Be aware that your ministry as a politician is a service for the dignity and freedom of the human life. Please be faithful to your vocation and dignity.
For NPR News in Philadelphia, I'm Buffy Gorilla.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. We'll be right back. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. This week, as we mark 3 years since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, among the many people offering up ideas for how to end that war is Alexander Vindman. Now, a little background here. Vindman was born in Ukraine, emigrated to the United States as a child. And if you recognize his name, there's a decent chance that is because of a moment back in 2019. When Vindman, by then a staffer in the Trump White House and an active duty officer in the U.S. Army, testified in impeachment hearings against his commander in chief.
Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals. Talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth.
Well, Trump fired Vindman not long after that. Then Vindman retired from the Army, but he has not stopped thinking about the relationship between the country for which he wore a uniform and the country where he was born. His new book is The Folly of Realism, How the West Deceived Itself About Russia and Betrayed Ukraine. Alexander Vindman, welcome.
Thank you for having me back.
So the last time you and I spoke was 3 years ago. It was actually right before Russia invaded. Let's start with the case for hope. Do you find grounds for hope that this year, that 2025 may be the year this war ends?
I don't think so. Not under the approach that the Trump administration is taking. It's an approach that looks to appease Russia in the tradition of 30 plus years of Russia first policy. And it's one where, frankly, Russia is not going to be satisfied with the level of appeasement that the Trump administration is offering, because the Ukrainians are not willing to capitulate. The prospects look dimmer now than they did before Trump took office.
I mentioned your own history, that Trump fired you, that he had you marched out of his White House. Just for people listening and wondering if you have an axe to grind, do you?
I've always been focused on U.S. national security. If you paid attention to any of my testimony back then or any of the commentary, it's not been about Ukraine. It's not really even been about Trump. I have no warm feelings towards him because he's a danger, in my view, to the U.S. But it's more about the professionalism that I've tried to uphold as a career military officer, as a policymaker, and as an academic studying this issue.
Well, and what's interesting is that in this latest book, you make the argument that the U.S. and its allies have gotten Ukraine wrong since the collapse of the Soviet Union, like across six U.S. presidential administrations of both parties. I'm sure there are many moments that stand out, but is there a particular one that, if it had been navigated differently, might have led us to a very different outcome today?
Sure. We should be clear that it wasn't just getting Ukraine wrong, it's getting Russia wrong consistently. With regards to what we could have done to support Ukraine, there are a couple of moments that stand out. Mm-hmm. I think in the Orange Revolution in 2004, we did very, very kid glove condemnations of Russia. We mm-hmm. should have warned them off and invested in Ukraine, and we didn't do that. There was another turning point in 2014, when it was clear that the Russians were graduating from hybrid warfare to outright military aggression.
This is when they seized Crimea.
Mm-hmm. Exactly right. We could have not done what we did, which was look to reset, but we could have avoided doing a reset and instead have been quite conditional in our relationship with Russia. Condemnatory when we needed to be, imposing sanctions, helping arm Ukraine so it looks like a harder target. That was another critical turning point.
So fast forward to this moment now, here we sit in 2025, with the world as it is, not as we wish it were. What counsel would you offer your successors at the White House, at the Pentagon, on trying to end this war?
What we should be doing is understanding that we could focus on long-term objectives. We could be focusing on making sure we have strong alliances with NATO, that our support for that collective defense treaty is ironclad. We should be investing in places like Ukraine or Taiwan, other places around the world that look like they could be the targets for the aggression of our adversaries.
I guess the pushback to that is that the Biden administration tried that, invested in the relationship with NATO, invested in Ukraine, and here we are with war still raging 3 years on.
I would say that that's not the case. I think the fact is that the Biden administration also fell afoul of hopes and fears. It just did it in a more kind of traditional vein, the same way that preceding administrations from George H.W. Bush through Clinton, through George Bush, President Obama, all committed the same kind of Russia first mistakes. Now it looks like there's a bit of a stark contrast because Trump has taken such an extreme approach to realism that it looks like the Biden administration did more than they actually did. The fact is that they also were a day late and a dollar short consistently in providing support to Ukraine.
When you argue for investing in Ukraine, is part of that argument more weapons to Ukraine? You make that case in the book.
That's an essential nature of bringing the war to a close. The problem, to a certain extent, is that both sides are relatively imbalanced. The Russians are making tiny incremental gains, but suffering enormous losses. They could weather some of those losses because they have a larger population, they have a larger economy, but they can't do that forever. And the Ukrainians are feisty and fiery. They've historically had higher morale, performed better on the battlefield, but they have limited human resources. And you're not going to find much of a compromise when both sides feel like they're on the cusp of winning or holding out or breaking the other side.
Last thing, do you see any grounds for optimism in the U.S.-Russia relationship? Understanding, as you've made clear, that you don't agree with the way President Trump is handling it, is it better to be talking than not to be talking?
I think it's a useful thing to have some conversations if those conversations are going to yield results. In this case, what needs to happen is we need to travel the road of folly for a little bit longer, where the Trump administration is going to attempt to bring this war to a close, but eventually recognize that there is really no compromising with Putin. And then the question is going to be, do we want Russia to be the winner, or do we want the U.S. to be the winner? Does Trump want Putin to be the winner, or does he want to be the winner himself? If he sees no prospect for Russia to compromise, the Russians are going to try to string along these negotiations. They're going to try to play at the fact that they're willing to end the war. But when they don't deliver, that's when there's an opportunity to rebalance and recognize that the support needs to go behind NATO, needs to go behind Ukraine, if we want to bring this war to close.
Retired U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman. His new book is The Folly of Realism. Alexander Vindman, thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Mathnasium, committed to making math fun and building confidence so students can achieve their potential this school year, offering customized math instruction and individual attention to students in grades K through 12. Mathnasium.com. From EBSCO, supporting open source technology and making open platforms possible for libraries of all sizes. Learn more at EBSCO.com. From Moderna, committed to protecting people from COVID-19, the CDC recommends getting a second dose of this season's COVID-19 vaccine for those 65 and older. Doctors can advise about getting a second dose. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering...
Places in my life and time, I've sung a lot of songs, I've made some bad rhymes, I spent my life in stages with 10,000 people watching. Yeah. Well, we're alone now, and I'm singing that song for you. I know your image.